This is the producer of the Bat Segundo Show. Now, before we begin, I'd like to offer a few shout-outs. If you haven't yet checked out Michael Rice's Cool as Hell theater podcast and you're interested in the San Francisco theater scene, you can do so by going to coolashelltheater.com. Rice is a man with more energy than Mr. Segundo has displayed in the entirety of the Bat Segundo Show run, which I suppose makes his podcast superior to ours. We've stayed up late, carefully read books, and he's still a better podcaster than us. We'll never be as good as Michael Rice. I mean, the man owns us on the courts, and he never even asked us to be on the Webzine podcast panel, and he's only 50 miles away! Anyway, do check him out. Also check out Pinky's Paper House, another fine literary podcast produced in Southern California. Now, her URL is paperhouse, paperhaus.typepad.com. Anyway, on with the show.
De un apartamental polga infestado, vienen los livings de un hombre encantador. It's Bat Segundo!
Another morning, another hangover, another Spanish man screaming in my ear. Kids, this is Bat Segundo, and I'm back after an extended stay in Cabo San Lucas. I'm not sure how I got there. I awoke in a seedy motel room and had to pay a strange woman for services I don't remember taking part in. But I suspect that Jorge had something to do with it, because when I got back to the studio, he poured a vat of scalding hot water over my head, called me un hombre triste, and told me that he was sick of mispronouncing my name. I told Jorge that, in fact, the name is pronounced Segundo and not Segundo, and he threatened to walk away. Then they start paying him a small stipend for his feverish exclamations, a lot more than me. Well, who's doing the real work here? I leave you to make the call. Well, anyway, that was the least of our worries for this program, because our young roving correspondent talked with Laura Joplin and somehow screwed it up. You see, a coffee grinder went off 5 minutes into the interview, and we had to pay a shady character named Alex to clean it up. Apparently, Alex wasn't paid for his work and sued us in small claims court. We never showed up. So we've had to stretch things thin around here, which means no tequila for me this week, but we apologize for the quality. He did the best he could. Of course, no one thought to consult me. I've had experience, certainly more than the questionable producers of this program. But all this is beside the point. Our guest this week is Laura Joplin. She's written a book called Love, Janice. Now, Laura is the sister of Janis Joplin, and as we learn from the book, apparently not related to Scott Joplin in any way. Our young roving correspondent talked with her in a noisy cafe, but Miss Joplin was very kind even when it seemed that the floors were being buffed, and our correspondent's questions were, well, how do we say this exactly? Highly questionable.
I am here with Laura Joplin. Thanks very much for being here. She is the author of Love, Janice, which is, and also the sister of Janis Joplin. Now, Laura, you initially wrote this book in 1992. What provoked you to write this book?
Well, the book really started in 1988 when my brother and I attended a memorial celebration in our hometown of Port Arthur, Texas. Mm-hmm. And there were thousands and thousands of incredibly welcoming, warm, just thundering applause type people at this crowd. It was just wonderful, and that was such an emotional experience that it just propelled me to want to know more about Janice and her relationship with fans and the public and how she was seen. And so I started trying to remember all the things I could. Mm-hmm. And wrote down ideas. And in the middle of that, my mother came up and offered me 25 letters that Janice had written home that I had not seen since we first received them in the 60s. And it was so wonderful to hear her describe her journey in the music world and what it was like and the excitement and the questions. And it really grounded me in terms of Janice being able to tell her own story.
Yeah.
That's what I liked about the letters, is it wasn't somebody's memory, it wasn't conflicting opinions, it was Janice just telling you what she went through.
No, the, truly the primary source.
Now, the interesting thing about the letters, too, is that they have a unique vernacular. Lots of ampersands, lots of psi, !
And drawings.
And drawings.
Yeah,
and
she illustrated them. Mm-hmm.
Now, this paperback edition has new letters, apparently. What can you describe sort of the new letters that went into this edition for those who may have actually read the hardcover?
Well, the first edition just had letters Janice wrote to her family, mm-hmm. whereas all of these new letters, which there's a group of 85 that I pulled from, some of them are written to a man she was engaged to, Peter mm-hmm. DeBlanc. Mm-hmm. Another group was written to her roommate, Linda Gravenides, and a third group was written to and from a man named David Niehaus, who was an important romantic figure right before her death.
Okay. Now, this book I noted, I had read actually the notorious biography, Buried Alive by Myra Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
And this book responds actually at several points to that biography. Do you view Friedman's book as a hatchet job or a genuine biography? Or does this book, how would you sort of compare this book with that one?
Well, Myra's book was the first one out, yeah. and it was written just a few years after her death. And I think, like a lot of books, you know, it reflects the author's perspective. I think I asked people when I interviewed them what they felt about the book, and I think people in general felt mixed about it, you know, that there were a lot of wonderful things, but they didn't agree with everything in it. But I think they'd probably say the same thing about my book, you know, that people have different views on things. I think that Myra truly has a great warmth and love for Janice, mm-hmm. and though it isn't the woman that I knew in Myra's book. It's too dark a book. You know, I remember Janice as full of joy, and she had an incredible sense of humor, and she was really bright. And I don't think that Myra's relationship with Janice, being her publicist and only seeing her in publicity relationships or when she was in New York, out of her element, I think that perhaps colors the book.
Mm, okay. Now, I understand the audiobook version of this was read by Deborah Winger. How did you actually get her for this?
Well, I didn't do it, but I thought it was pretty awesome.
Okay.
You know, we had talked to a company that puts out books on tape, and they said that Deborah Winger wanted to do it, and wow, you know, I mean, that was really an honor for Janice.
Okay. Now, I also want to talk also about you, because you're the author of the book, and you have a PhD in education. I'm wondering how much of your own sort of personal drive to obtain a PhD or doctorate had to do with your upbringing. It seems that in regard to this, you had sort of a lot in common with Janice. I recently saw the Dick Cavett DVDs, which had, mm-hmm. of course, Janice on them. The thing that really impressed about me was her devotion to her performance. She's sitting there, and she's just giving her emotional all. She's literally, like, shuddering and convulsing and everything. And I'm wondering, did working on this book and revisiting these years provide you with sort of a new way of seeing similarities between you and your sister? Or?
Well, certainly I feel like I got to know her better.
Yeah.
And I think it fleshed out some of the memories that I had of the year, say, that she was at home before she went and joined Big Brother, and her relationship with Peter DeBlanc. That was fleshed out for sure. I think that my own interest in education and trying to understand things, and really I studied experience-based learning. You know, I'm sure there is some commonality between Janice and I, and we had a real active, engaging family in terms of talking about ideas and things. But I think I was mostly trying to understand her. I was just always someone who was interested in books and ideas, and I suppose most everyone in the family was. Our weekly social trip with my father was to go to the library, and the one surefire way that you could get out of chores was if you were reading a good book and looked very serious. So, you know, reading was important in the house. And if Janice loved to read, she read a lot of novels and biographies. She read a lot about painters, because when she was young, she was a painter before a singer. And me, I was always more into ideas and wide-ranging ideas. So I actually got into education because I became involved with a college, Prescott College, and was so fascinated by their approach to learning. It was kind of an outward bound model, using the outdoors as a classroom, and they had a journal system portfolio for student evaluation that I decided to go back and do a non-traditional doctorate degree in experience-based learning as it relates to structured journals, and so develop some materials, and I just loved it. Besides that, I got to learn to do kayaking and go down rivers, and gosh, that was awesome.
Now, did you read F. Scott Fitzgerald just like Janice did?
Well, I did, especially when I was doing the book. Uh-huh. And I particularly went back and read Zelda because there was comments about Janice reading Zelda.
She praised that on the Cabot
Show, yeah.
Identifying
with it. And so I wanted to see where she was at. Certainly when Janice was at home, I had a tendency to sneak the literature off her shelves and see what she was up to because she was reading stuff that my parents would never let me check out of the library. So, yeah, good stuff.
Okay. Now, in this book, you also go out of your way to set the record straight about Janice's heroin overdose, pointing out that the dope that Janice used was 4 times stronger than the usual variety. And throughout the book, we read this, and we see that Janice is attempting to sort of get herself off of this. Do you think that despite this particular terrible accident, do you think that she would have eventually kicked heroin or would have had a different life, or do you think that...
I certainly like to believe that, and it fits her style, because even though she had gotten involved in drugs and alcohol several different times, she herself had pulled back from an abusive amount of use. It's a cyclical thing, and she just hadn't been able to get totally free. And face it, I mean, she was involved in 1960s era psychedelic rock and roll. This was not the community that cautioned you about, being temperate in your views.
Yeah.
So I think that given more time, she would have continued that because she was already discussing it with her friends and they were beginning to wonder, what they wanted to do and stuff. And there was a divergence.
Okay. Now, much of your experience with Janice is actually in her early life. And as her career sort of started going forward, she began spending, I guess, less time with you and your family. That's the sort of impression I got. Because of this, and we were talking about sort of the comparison between your biography and Myra Friedman's biography, do you think that there's some sort of medium here that needs to be sort of discovered, or that during that period, do you think you're wholly qualified to cover that period? Or
I think there's many people who write books who don't know anything about the subject, and the point is you're supposed to go interview people and research people that do know so that you can do it, and that's what I attempted to do in the book, is to fill in the areas that I didn't know about. Now, I think that my book is different from some rock and roll biographies because it's a book about a person.
Yeah.
It's not a book chronicling each drug use, each romantic partner. That's, to me, background. That was a part of her life, but it wasn't the dominant force, and it wasn't who she was. And I saw her perhaps differently in that regard than other people did.
But you wanted to capture, I think, more of her essence, which I think seems to stand out in this biography compared to, say, other ones which are sort of going out of their way to maybe do a hatchet job or the like.
Well, I think some people are just so interested in that, which to me is more trivia kind of stuff, those details. Whereas, because I knew her so much when she was younger, I spend a lot of time in the book kind of capturing her personality, her questions, her interests and things. And so I think that I'm therefore kind of required to carry that through a certain amount once she enters the arena of the music world. And so it's just different. One of the people commented after the first edition was out, he said that Janice comes across a little differently in my book because I spend a lot of time talking about the context in which she lived, trying to explain the nature of the scene she was in, what was happening in history, and that's true during the time period when we grew up or while she was involved in the Haight-Ashbury rock and roll scene, that the context lets you see what other people around her were doing. And in that sense, she doesn't come across as that different.
Yeah. So in terms of being Janis Joplin's sister, was there a period in your life, perhaps shortly after her death, that you sort of had to deal with the burden of being either Janis Joplin's sister or Laura Joplin, or did you reconcile that in some way? Or?
Well, I think that given that the family has, developed a responsibility for some of her continuing business, and I've done a fair amount of that, I've had to deal with that question, but not as much as you might think. You know, and I think that because I am not personally involved in the music world and have had a professional life separate from that, but it's just sometimes with some people. And I've grown to really respect the role that Janis has had in people's lives.
Sure.
And I've been very curious because there's so many wonderful stories that come out. There's one guy, I remember after my mother lived in a little town in Arizona, Prescott, and she used to garden a lot. And she was out in her front yard once weeding or doing whatever she's doing. And this guy in his pickup truck just pulls up. He stops. He gets out and he walks over. And he says, "I just want you to know that the day Janis died, I quit using drugs. Because if she couldn't do it, I couldn't do it." And then he got in his truck and left. You know, it's like, and my brother who lived in Arizona for a long time on the Day of the Dead, you know, which is a big celebration holiday in Hispanic culture, people drive by his house and they just honk.
Yeah.
You know, and it's those ways of feeling connected and how you're surrounded by a loving community that has wonderful memories that she gave to people, gave them strength and honor and a sense of wonder about music and just all that joy. So, yeah, it's a mixture.
Okay. Now, there are several Janis biopics, film biopics in the works right now. How do you feel about either Pink or Renee Zellweger playing your sister?
Well, you know, I think that I would love to see a great film made about Janis.
Yeah.
And I think that women deserve to have Janis treated for her strength. Because, you know, we as women have come a long way in defining our place in the world. And when you look at someone like Janis and you see, are they going to see the power and the incredible intelligence and drive in the woman to achieve what she did, or are they merely going to talk about drugs and sex, which to me is an insult to femininity as much as it is to Janis. And as to who does it, I just hope it's someone who loves her and can really carry off that sense of power. And, you know, there's a lot of wonderful things to be said about Renee. I don't know as much about Pink, but I do enjoy her music.
Well, she does a song called "Let's Get This Party Started." So,
so yeah, keep going.
Okay. Now, let's see here. Oh, yeah, I wanted to talk about briefly Seth Morgan, Janis's fiancé at the end of her life. I noticed that you also took him to task quite a lot, noting that he tried to crawl into bed with you at Janis's wake party, and he was playing strip pool one night that Janis needed him. The sense I'm getting here is that Seth Morgan, you don't have particularly fond feelings for this guy. Can you elaborate on this?
You know, I just never heard anybody say a whole lot of real good things about him.
Yeah.
Certainly there were stories people had of the quiet times with them together, you know, sitting at home reading or, you know, those kind of domestic things. But I'm not 100% sure that Seth was the real deal or if he was just kind of a compromise because, you know, the type of man she really wanted, this strong, powerful person who created his own life, wasn't really likely to put up with the role of being Mr. Joplin in the rock scene, whereas Seth seemed to gravitate to that role itself and like it. And maybe that's, you know, some of what I don't feel comfortable with about him.
Yeah.
You know, and he, you know, there's just his own life story after Janis is certainly not one to be applauded.
No, but he did at least get one book out of him afterwards.
He did. Yeah, he did.
Yeah. Now, in terms of Janis balancing her career and her love life, this is a common theme throughout your book. I'm wondering, did she confide specifically to you about this on the phone or in person, or was it more of a sisterly thing? I'm just wondering what basis you have for many of these sort of focus.
The year that she was at home before she joined Big Brother, 65, 66, she was engaged to Peter DeBlanc.
Yeah.
And even though he turned out to be, you know, something of a questionable sort himself, there were many wonderful, glorious aspects to that relationship. For a long time, Janice wrote him letters all the time, and he came down to the house and formally asked my father for hand in marriage and would send her a dozen long-stem red roses and, you know, things like that that were very romantic and were filling her mind with, you know, wonderful visions and a future. And she was also coming off of a period of weakness and getting strung out in speed, and she was hunting for something to lean on. Peter probably wasn't someone she could really lean on, but for a while in her mind, he worked just fine, and it grounded her. It gave her certain strength. And during that period, she and I shared a bedroom for a while and shared clothes and spent a lot of time together. And so we talked a lot about men and what we wanted in our lives.
Yeah.
And those visions, that kind of girl talk that you do. Janice was into building a trousseau and sewing a quilt. And, you know, I mean, she
was she building a trousseau?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, you know, there were
lots of madras there.
Some. So, you know, she was buying glasses at Pier 1 and things like that. You know, just storing up little things. So there were some things. And certainly some of the other ideas are, again, quotes from other people and taken from letters.
Okay. Do you think that the world right now needs a Janice figure? Now, perhaps more than ever, because the times I see right now are very similar in their sort of, you know, craziness as they were roughly between 68 through 70.
Oh, boy, I really think the times need to go back and remember the 60s.
Yeah.
Because I think that there's so much wonderfulness in the 60s that we could use right now. And you take someone like Janice, someone who was a straight talker, you know, tell it like it is. Boy, wouldn't that be a breath of fresh air today to have people just right up there saying what's on their mind. I think there's a lot of strength and value in Janice in the 60s that can benefit the challenges that we have today. And in many ways, I think they're very similar challenges.
Well, even like the red state, blue state division. Have someone who's talked straight from Texas actually get up there and have the whole world.
Well, you know, in the 60s, there was always that, are you on the bus or off the bus?
Yeah.
You know, the seventh thing that you know, you were either open up, open to the 60s, open to the ideas, you either turned on or you hadn't. And so there was a division there. You were either four piece or you weren't. And, you know, there were a lot of things that I think we're still, in some ways, dealing with the same questions. We haven't resolved it. The issues take different forms. But again, you know, we've got a war and we're dealing with generation differences and, you know, and again, we haven't got the basic value of the 60s, which I think it said, hey guys, one planet, one civilization, you know, we work together, you know, we're here. It's not us and them, we're one, and we need to remember that.
How do you account for the continued and enduring sort of popularity and legacy of Janis Joplin even to this day, that there continues to be this unprecedented interest in her?
Well, I think it's just what you said a minute ago. I think that Janice will be remembered and talked about as long as she is controversial. And the ideas that she was active in, really about women's roles, how to be a strong, capable, independent person within a world that's really run by men, and women's sexuality, how to be sexy, how to express yourself, be open and honest about it, whether it's, you know, straight, you know, or homosexual or heterosexual, whatever you want, but it's how to be who you are. And the idea of personal integrity, whether that's in one-to-one relationships or business relationships, you know, the honesty, the integrity of it, to me, those are a lot of the issues that Janice spoke to and lived more than, you know, some of the other issues of the times. But I still don't think we've settled those things. And I think that's why she's remembered as a lifestyle figure. I think basically Janice was just an incredible singer. I mean, she had a voice. Anytime I put her music on or I just hear it on the radio or something, you know, I stop and I just have to remember, separate from the woman, separate from my sister, separate from letters or anything else, She could sing.
Oh, yeah.
And she conveyed emotion. She was just so good.
Yeah. I had a little question about the use of Mercedes-Benz, which is this lovely song. But it was used in a Mercedes-Benz commercial. And I'm wondering, did you have any input in this? Or what? Why was this done? Because it seems to me very sort of contrary to the kind of goofball sort of pure values of this song. So, you know, it was sort of like, we don't really need a Mercedes-Benz. Why was it used in a Mercedes-Benz commercial?
God, I thought it was such a hoot. I mean, gosh, has the world come full circle or what? You know, to me, it was an honor. And it was a statement of how, you know, the new, our young generation, of course, we're not the young ones anymore, you know, has really gotten to the point of buying Mercedes. I thought it was fun. But people did raise that question, and I went and talked to Michael McClure, who, you know, was a well-known poet and
co-writer
of the song, and penned the phrase, "Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz," that Janice then elaborated on in her song. And I asked him, and he thought it was grand fun, you know. So, it's one of those things where people have different opinions.
A lot of people compare it to the use of the Beatles' "Revolution" in that Nike ad, you know, which was to me was one of the most. I have to side with the people who sort of, you know, you sort of have a particular sort of meaning to the song, and you sort of see it used to sort of sell a product. I mean, certainly those that kind of goes completely different from the original intent of the song, which is this, you know.
Well, I think also, you know, it's the challenge of, how do you be subculture, commenter on society, separate from society, but talk about being one, you know, being community. You know, it's kind of the need to include everything. And I think the full circle idea that it was written from someone, you know, commenting on society, and then all of a sudden it's the middle of society, that's kind of how the world works.
Would you use other Janice songs for commercials? Or?
There have been some, you know, more out of this country. Not as much, so that's in terms of the publishing of the songs that Janice wrote, because to do a commercial like that, you have to get permission of the author.
Yeah.
You know, that was, I think, the primary song that Janice wrote, the biggest one. Most of the others were written by other people.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, just one final question really quick. Do you have any other sort of planned books, perhaps relating to education or a follow-up volume on Janice's life? Or do you think that this, that Love Janice sort of sums everything up?
Oh, there's a lot of things that run through my mind here and there. I think Love Janice really gives you a whole package of information about her, because she can speak for herself through all the letters and the excerpts from letters that are in it. And I feel you get a real good sense of the family and the background and the grounding and on into the lyrics and her success that chronicles through that time period, all the quotes and stuff from people. So I think you get a real sense of who she was. I think it'd be fun sometime to just do a book of letters and have all of them. And they were too
very
lengthy
like,
to put in this.
Oh, sort of like the letters of Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I think it could be, that could be fun. But you never know how they there's always ways to use things.
Well, thank you so much, Laura Joplin. It was a pleasure having you here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.